It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Biden administration is talking about its recent accomplishments ahead of the midterm elections. We'll explore how recent bills and executive action could mobilize voters this November. First, four legal action groups filed a lawsuit against Governor Evers and members of the Wisconsin Public Defender Board last Tuesday. The Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and other groups behind the suit say the public defender system needs to be reformed as there's a backlog of about 35,000 pending criminal cases in the state of Wisconsin. That's causing those charged with criminal cases to wait weeks, sometimes months, for an appointed attorney. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by this backlog of cases, or do you know someone who has? Do you work in the criminal justice system? What are you seeing in courts in your neck of the woods? Do you see a need for changes in the state's public defender system? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ian Main is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. He teaches civil procedure, criminal procedure, civil rights, and race in the law. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob.
This is a problem a long time in the making. Before we dig into that history, what do you make of this lawsuit and what the plaintiffs are hoping to achieve here?
It's a really important lawsuit. It brings attention two ways. One, just publicly, like the conversation we're having today. So thank you to all the listeners, and I hope it generates more interest in what is an ongoing crisis. And then as to just the legal aspect, it is a class action lawsuit that's asking permission to form as a class. The court is being asked to identify that there is a class here, and the class would be indigent individuals who have waited 14 days for an attorney after their initial appearance. And then should they prevail in the certification, what they're asking for is they'd like to, after 14 days, have it declared that in Wisconsin, if someone waits more than 14 days since their initial appearance, that's an indigent defendant, someone who cannot afford counsel, if one of those individuals waits more than 14 days, the lawsuit asks the court to declare that in Wisconsin to be unconstitutional, and that if the named defendants do not, therefore, thereafter, appoint someone immediately to represent that individual, that the charges against that individual would be dismissed with prejudice. So that's what the lawsuit is asking for.
That's going to strike, I think, a lot of people as drastic, saying, okay, 2 weeks and then we're dismissing potentially criminal charges. Can you talk about that expectation, though, of speedy justice?
Well, there, you know, that's interesting. I mean, the expectation, I guess, under the Constitution is reasonable. And you can read all the law journals you want on this and all the cases you want. You're not going to find a definition of what reasonable delay is. And so largely the U.S. Supreme Court leaves it to the states to, or even individual counties to determine what reasonable is. And so there's a lot of leeway. So as you're suggesting, I think what this lawsuit is doing is asking for a court, not a legislature, a court to declare what point is reasonable. And they're asking 14 days should be kind of the limit of what's reasonable to be appointed to counsel. And then the question is whether that is a drastic view. And I imagine there's debate on that. I certainly don't think it's drastic. I think there should be an immediate appointment of counsel. In fact, I think there should be the availability of counsel before the initial appearance. In many respects, although it's not constitutionally required, it is, from my perspective, a critical point in the litigation before charges are filed so that you can negotiate with a prosecutor or a DA before, like after the referral from the police department, but before the prosecutor actually charges the case. And we don't even have representation there. And so you'll have, you know, defendants languishing in jail for days without having any contact with a counsel because they have no constitutional right to one. When they finally have an initial appearance and they're given a bail amount, which they can't pay and therefore are subject to continued pretrial detention, then they're told that they have a right to an attorney, but one never shows up. And yet they're still sitting in jail. They could be losing their employment. Their family could be subject to eviction from their house. And then the statistics show us that those who are subject to pretrial detention, from a public safety point of view, the statistics are sobering that a fair amount of individuals, that there's the longer you detain people on average raises their public safety risk. And therefore, what the statistics show is that people who are subject by and large to longer pretrial periods of detention have higher levels of recidivism. So, you know, when we talk about what's drastic or what's not drastic, we have to think about what it means from an individual point of view of a defendant subject to a state with immense powers, and yet you're alone, you're isolated. You're usually, you know, if you're put in jail, you're in a place that has all types of folks, many suffering serious mental illness, many who might have actually committed a serious crime, where you, the vast majority of folks in the situation of the class, have not committed a serious crime, unless you think some kind of drug possession or selling drugs is really serious, but that's generally what we're looking at. And, you know, they're in a situation that's very unhealthy. They're cut off from the family. So it's terrifying. And so from my perspective, if you put me in a cage for a day and I'm not supposed to be there, that's a major trauma. And I'd want to file a lawsuit against anyone who does that to me. So if we don't view putting someone in jail as an act of violence, then yeah, it doesn't look drastic. If we accept this as normal, that we are continuing to put people without charges in the jail for sometimes over 3 or 4 months, in the kind of the terror of the situation that's created by the jail, then yeah, that's going to be a normalized thing, that's not drastic at all. But from my point of view, if you put me in a cage, that is a violent act. So I think it's a very, very important, critical incident that needs immediate treatment and intervention by a representative.
We're talking to UW-Madison law professor Ian Main about a lawsuit filed against the state's public defender system, saying there's a big backlog. It's keeping people in jail for a long time awaiting trial. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Ian, let's talk about how we got here. Why do we have such a shortage of people available to serve as public defenders here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in some respects, it's an easy answer. And in some respects, it's not. I mean, the easy part is you don't get paid. So if you're a public defender, you know, you get hired onto the public defender, probably starting around $50,000 in Wisconsin a year. And that's, you don't have overhead, right? You're given a salary. So that's where you are a state employee working for and supervised by the state public defender and the apparatus created by government. And those folks and public servants who do amazing work for the most part and are paid really, very low for someone carrying the kind of debt that law people who graduate from law school usually do, is they can only take so many cases. And there's lots of reasons for that. One, you know, these offices, both prosecutors' offices and criminal or public defender offices, in terms of how many people are there, it's remained pretty static over a long period of time. And yet we've seen a steady increase in the number of police in every county. And with that, you get more and more arrests. And with that, you get kind of a fire hose effect coming in from the prosecutor's office. The prosecutors can't review these cases as closely. It goes to the public defender to review, but they're inundated as well because they don't have the personnel to review all these cases. And so in one aspect, there's just a rising caseload problem because we don't have, there's not a commensurate increase in the number of prosecutors and defense attorneys when there's an increase in, say, the police presence. And so that creates a mismatch over time that something's going to break. The other aspect is that there's a conflict. So there's conflicts in certain situations where the public defender can't take the case. Either it's another defendant who has a conflict with their own client and therefore has to be given an independent counsel. And that's called assigned counsel. About 40%, generally 40% of the cases in Wisconsin go to assigned counsel. These are individuals who are not supervised really by the state public defender. They're on a list and they have discretion to take as many cases they want or as few as many or no cases at all. And they are paid at this point $70 an hour. And that, you know, if someone says, wait, $70 an hour, that's over 40 hour a week, that's $140,000 a year. And that's that kind of perception is what makes this really, really hard to navigate. Because in the end of the day, the people who are willing to serve as assigned counsel and pick up that 40% kind of cases that need to be picked up that can't be covered by the state public defender is dwindling and dwindling quickly. I served as an assigned counsel for about a year and a half in Wisconsin. I viewed it as a pro bono position in which I was volunteering my time in between two jobs. And I had a partner who made good money, and therefore we as a kind of family unit decided it's okay for me to kind of do what we viewed as pro bono work. At that point, I was paid $40 an hour, and now it's $70 an hour. But when the public hears $70 an hour, they hear $70 an hour, but that's not even close to what it is. In fact, per hour, that's a billable hour. And a billable hour, hard to explain, but is about 1.8 hours. So what we're really talking about is if you're $70 per hour, that's really closer to $40 an hour. That doesn't take into consideration all the overhead, the office, the rent, the equipment, any personnel that you have, insurance, errors and omissions insurance. It doesn't take into bar fees. And it doesn't take into fact that there's a blended fee much lower if you're driving from point A to B. And of course, we heard about in the news a huge number of the need, a lot of the need is in rural areas, which means folks from Madison and Milwaukee have to drive to those places. And so, you know, there was a study in Indiana done by an agency in Indiana, and it had a similar kind of $70 in the range per hour rate for those assigned counsel. And they did a study asking 205 different attorneys who were assigned counsel making $70 a billable hour. They found that on average, that individual pulled in about $67,000 a year, and that overhead was around $50,000 plus other costs. So that, and this is from an agency kind of report, those attorneys were making about $6 or $7 an hour.
We're talking to Ion Main, assistant professor at UW-Madison's Law School, looking at a lawsuit filed in an effort to reform the public defender system in the state. A big backlog there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. We'll continue the conversation. Get to your calls coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ion Main, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School, with us to talk about a lawsuit filed by four legal action groups saying a shortage of public defenders is unfair to many defendants in the court system. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Larry is with us in Kingston. Larry, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a son who is locked up now in Green Lake County Jail. He's a med-boarded, retired Green Beret weapons specialist. He did two tours in Iraq and two in Afghanistan, and they were going to send him to Africa, and he said he couldn't do it anymore. And he got med-boarded out of the service, but he's been around those burn piles and everything, and he's got mental health issues, PTSD, he's bipolar now. And about every 2 years, he decides to go off his medications, and he raises hell. And I called the police on him four times the last time he was home, part of the reason why he's in jail. But what I wonder is, why doesn't the VA pick these guys up that they know are messed up because of what they've seen and what they've done in war, and just pick them up and take them to the hospital that they need?
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. A little outside of your expertise there, I'm guessing, Ion, with the VA issue. But, Larry, and Larry, best to your family and your son. But to Larry's point about people with mental health problems, there's some of who we're talking about in this backlog in our jails now, right?
That's exactly right. And Larry, thank you for your call and thank you for your son's service. And I'm so sorry that's the way your son is being treated. I find that absolutely you know, a mistreatment of your son. And I have a lot of sympathy for what you're going through and what your son is going through. I do believe that we should have a public health response. I do not think that mental health kind of disruptions in one's mental health should be criminalized to the extent possible. And it goes to what I was saying before as well, is and this is different from your more important point, Larry, which is we definitely should have a kind of community resource response to, for example, episodes that say your son may have when understandably he goes off meds and he can be stabilized. And that's much less harm to society than and to him than putting him then in jail, which is creates even more kind of it's even more painful and harmful to your son and has pretty bad outcomes for society. But this gets to the less important point, but also relevant to this case or this lawsuit, is it's really important, I think, that the attorney gets in there really early, because if you get in there early as an attorney, I know that if I talk to, say, you, Larry, about your son's history, I can immediately go to the prosecutor and see if that there's some kind of programming and some kind of diversion or alternative that we might consider rather than keeping your son in pretrial detention or punishing him for, especially after all his service, and when we're really talking about a mental health issue. So this issue is really important. We rely on our public defenders to do this kind of intervention. As Larry says, we should be relying on community resources or the VA or local resources. We aren't. We should be, but the next best thing is to get early intervention by a public defender or an assigned counsel.
Larry, thanks for that call. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hello.
Good afternoon. Unfortunately, I think waiting for an attorney when you've committed a crime is a collateral consequence crime, and society will do its best to fix you up, but to say it has to happen within 2 weeks is ridiculous. Honestly, solution in within 2 weeks? Are they, you know, compensated for their medical injuries at the hands of a violent criminal?
Tom, thanks for the call. To Tom's first point, Ian, if somebody commits a crime, Tom feels they shouldn't have an expectation of representation in that two-week time window.
Yeah, and I understand Tom's perspective and appreciate it. And his focus on victims is important and on those who are subject to violence. And I also would support a much more robust kind of response from the state, county, and municipalities as to providing victims immediate support who have been subject to violent episodes. Many times, violent victims are left out of this discussion. Left out of the process or not part of this process and kind of have to deal with their pain and trauma by themselves without support. There are counties that are starting to bring in more resources, which I applaud. And so I absolutely understand that piece, although I don't think it connects necessarily to how we treat defendant. I do think it's important that we give those kind of critical resources to victims. There's also an important aspect to put this in perspective, and violent crime is obviously something we should focus on and be cognizant of. But what happens too is that is the important tip of an iceberg, but there is an iceberg. And the iceberg involves a lot of what we call lifestyle crimes, whether this disorderly conduct, which gets close to violence, but is not, drug kind of use, possession, selling, vandalism, being public disorder, whatever that might be. And so there's a lot of, and the vast majority of cases in which we are putting someone in detention, which again, if you don't think putting someone in a cage is violent, then we're just not on the same page. But I think it's an extreme situation that, you know, if the state says you have to go into a cage, and if we're going to do that, then we should make sure that the person has representation and that their rights are being respected and that that's where they should be versus that they've been that in fact they didn't commit the crime, that they've been, the charges are incorrect, that the person should not be detained for various reasons. There should be probation and they should be immediately released. And so we undo the kind of problems of creating unnecessarily unemployed individuals. that undermines public health and public safety. And so I think we have to look at this as a system. I think we do need to take care of our victims of violent crime, for sure. We have to keep our eye on the fact that the vast majority of crimes are not violent. And we have to actually give kind of the a fair kind of assessment of what we're actually doing to individuals when we send them to a jail and imprison them.
Thanks for that call. And Ion, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
That's Ion Main, associate professor at UW-Madison Law School, who teaches civil procedure, criminal procedure, civil rights, and race and the law. Ion talked to us today about a lawsuit filed last Tuesday against the governor and members of the Wisconsin Public Defender Board in an effort to reform the public defender system, problem a long time in the making. You could still share your thoughts if you've had an experience with any part of this, been accused of a crime, a victim of a crime, and you've seen it take a long time to resolve. If you've worked as a public defender or a prosecutor, love to hear your story. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at recent action from the Biden administration on Congress on things like student loan debt, climate change, and firearms, and whether that might boost Democrats in the November midterm elections. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or by downloading the Wisconsin Public Radio app. And if you hear a great conversation that you want to share with somebody, you can do that with the archive feature, both online and on the app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we help you decide what to read next with some memes. Now, President Biden announced today that he's coming to Milwaukee to speak on Labor Day, just 2 months before the midterm elections. On recent stops, he's highlighted the accomplishments of his administration, most recently the cancellation of some student loan debt and the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act. Those actions come along with recent improvements in polling for the Biden administration and changes in political polling and special elections since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have recent actions from the Biden administration and Congress changed how you feel about these midterm elections and who you're going to vote for better or for worse? Will student loan forgiveness or the Inflation Reduction Act influence how you vote in November? Do you think those moves and others from the Biden administration will help drive voter turnout in the midterm? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Smith is a distinguished professor of social sciences and a professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, it seems almost old-fashioned and normal, Steve. A party does stuff while they control the government and then goes out to election, takes it to voters for an up or down vote. I don't know. Do voters vote based on what actually gets done in Washington anymore?
Well, they do, but there's less of it than there has been in the past. Partisan preferences are dictating voting behavior in the general public more than we've seen in really several generations. And so attitudes about the incumbent president, the party in power, are pretty well fixed on the basis of just who they are, what their party label is. But there still remains a sizable number of Americans who are not committed to either party, and maybe just a few partisans who can switch sides. But it's mainly those independents, those people in the middle, people who are not too attentive to politics most of the time, who can still sway or determine the outcome of elections. And there are still enough close elections so that it can tip the balance for majority control of Congress.
do you see parties and political leaders focusing more on those persuadable voters, those people who could conceivably vote for either party, or in a midterm election, focusing on making sure the same people who showed up in the presidential year on our side, whichever side that is, show up in this midterm year?
It's a tough question to answer. We have reason to think that maybe this midterm is going to be a little different than midterms we've seen. You know, emotions are running high right now about a number of issues. We've seen a surge in voter registration among women in some key states as a result of the Dodd decision on abortion by the Supreme Court. We've seen some late success with the Inflation Reduction Act on the part of the incumbent party. And, you know, on the economic side, inflation is high, but it doesn't seem to be continuing to rise. Unemployment is way up and consumer spending is high, which indicates some confidence in the future. So the incumbent party, the Democrats, who we thought would really be in a very difficult spot by now, seem to have recovered their position a bit, making the outcome in November very uncertain.
Let's look at some of the most recent news here. We had the Biden administration using an executive action to forgive a decent chunk of student loan debt to a lot of borrowers holding that debt, going to appeal presumably to a lot of Democratic supporters, Republicans criticizing it, but maybe worried about the impact on votes. Well, listen to Republican Senator Ted Cruz from Texas talking last week on his podcast.
There is a real risk if you are that slacker barista who wasted 7 years in college studying completely useless things, now has loans and can't get a job. Joe Biden just gave you 20 grand. Like, holy cow, 20 grand. That, you know, maybe you weren't going to vote in November and suddenly you just got 20 grand. And, you know, if you can, you know, get off the bong for a minute and head down to the voting station or just send in your mail-in ballot that the Democrats have helpfully sent you, it could drive up turnout. Particularly among young people.
Do you see that particular executive action potentially driving up turnout for Democrats, or maybe that backlash that we're hearing there driving up turnout for Republicans, Steve?
Well, the backlash, I think, was pretty sharp, but I think remarkably brief. It lasted a few days, a week. And the last couple of days, you know, we're off on other issues. One of the difficulties for the Republicans this year is that Trump keeps squeezing out their regular message. They would like to talk about things like wasteful government spending and the unfairness of administration actions, but their message gets pushed to the side by news about what's happening in Mar-a-Lago or elsewhere. So they're their own worst enemy on an issue like this. In general, I think that the student loan issue will work to the advantage of the Democrats. You know, people who oppose it are not likely to vote on the basis of the student loan action. They're going to dislike Biden and the Democrats for plenty of other reasons. But there will be a large number of people, we know it numbers in the millions, who are going to benefit with the forgiveness program that will save many of them $10,000 and maybe an equal number, about $20,000. They will remember that. And so the direct beneficiaries, for them, it's a big deal. And I think on balance, it'll benefit the Democrats, sure.
Talking to Stephen Smith, Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis, political scientist there, looking at the road ahead now to the midterm elections and the many different issues, the bills passed in Congress, executive actions, abortion, Biden's approval rating, Trump's approval rating and persistence in the news. What are you watching? What is motivating you as you look ahead to these elections? Are you locked in? Have you been locked in all along? Or do you consider yourself persuadable? Or do you know someone who is? They're rare. They're out there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your personal opinion. Or if you want to play pundit and think, ask about, tell us which issue you think is going to make a difference. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, you touched on the abortion issue in these midterms. We had the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade, throw things back to the states. Bans now in effect, partial or complete, in Wisconsin and a lot of other places. What are you seeing so far in things like polling and special elections that might hint at the impact of that come November?
Well, the most direct evidence is that in states that have taken some steps against abortion, that there's been a surge in registration among women. And of course, you have to register in order to vote. So it's a pretty important signal, I think, that on balance, the abortion issue is likely to work in the favor of the Democrats. And that's not too surprising. You know, in politics, generally speaking, negative reactions to what's going on motivate people more than positive ones. those who are upset with the Supreme Court decision and when the actions taken in many states are more likely to be motivated to vote than those who favored it. So on balance, that works for the Democrats. And since women are already favor Democrats more than Republicans, the gender gap might even be larger this time. And that's probably good news for the Democrats. So there are a number of things here, Rob, that work in favor of the Democrats. Nevertheless, the Republicans are holding their own in most of the polls about who people intend to vote for. But the distance between the two parties has narrowed considerably. Essentially, the average of the polls now shows essentially a tie on what's called the generic congressional ballot. That is, people are asked in general whether they intend to vote for the Democrat or Republican candidate for Congress in their district. And it's now on a national basis about a tie. And so that's an improvement over the last few months for the Democrats. However, districting advantages the Republicans. So a tie vote in national polls means that the Republicans will probably win more districts, almost certainly will. I would hazard a guess based on the good studies I've read. If a tie vote's likely to produce about a 15 or 20 seat Republican advantage. And that's enough to make the House majority Republican after the election.
We're talking to Washington University social sciences and political science professor Steve Smith about the upcoming midterm elections and how recent action from the Biden administration, recent bills passed by Congress, might influence voter turnout. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on particular issues. Do you approve of the Biden administration's student loan, a partial forgiveness, or some of the bills passed in Congress by the Democrats, the one focused on climate change, the infrastructure bill? Do the administration's actions change how you're going to vote this November? Does abortion motivate you, whichever side you're on? Do you know people who are maybe paying more attention to the elections because of that or the other issues we're talking about? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Oh, and our races here in Wisconsin, should ask you about those. The Senate race, Mandela Barnes, incumbent Ron Johnson. What do you want to hear from them? What issues have you excited or worried about one or the other? How about Evers, Michaels for governor? Same questions, 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're bringing up our talk with Steve Smith, professor of political science and social sciences at Washington University in St. Louis, with us today looking at how things like student loan debt forgiveness, the Inflation Reduction Act, other recent action from the Biden administration could affect voters, mobilize them on one side or another in the November midterm elections. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. What are you paying attention to in these elections? What race is front and center in your mind? Is there a particular issue that has you excited or worried for the November elections? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathy from Harsha called in and said she wants to see representative government again. She thinks political parties are keeping us from having representation and that politicians are too loyal to the parties, not the people. Steve, I know political parties sometimes have a bad reputation. What do you think about Kathy's worries?
I think it's a widely shared worry. It's one that I share too, because we do worry that parties become so partisan that they care more about winning than they do care about governing. And so there's a trade-off there that I think we have to worry about. But let's be realistic. Parties serve democracy in very important ways. And they're going to form whether we like them or not, because people who are like-minded, people who share the same policy objectives, are going to organize with each other in parties to try to win elections and to try to influence policy choices. So they are essentially inevitable. The question is, how do we encourage them to work with each other? And it could very well be that the two parties are at this moment so different and so evenly matched on a national basis that it's going to keep this sharp polarization with us for the foreseeable future. But parties, I'm afraid, if we like democracy and we like our large democracy, are going to be with us whether we like it or not.
Kathy, thanks for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Steve, I started off by mentioning that President Biden planning on coming to Wisconsin on Labor Day. We saw former President Trump campaigning with a lot of people leading up to primaries in various states. How big an impact do you think it could have for a Biden visit, a Trump visit to key battleground states like Wisconsin?
Well, presidential elections do start earlier and earlier. The Trump story, of course, is in many ways a special case. He wants to maintain his own viability by doing favors for Republicans around the country. Of course, he wants to retain his own viability, his personal visibility and popularity with Republican audiences. But at the same time, he's trying to build a base of support among Republican activists and politicians, people who may owe him something in a couple of years from now when we're in a presidential election year. So, you know, it makes sense. It's a special case because seldom do we have a politician who is so visible, a former president who's a potential candidate for the president in the future. It's just an unusual circumstance. It's not unusual for a sitting president to start thinking about visiting states that might be important to winning re-election. That's a very old story. So it's not too surprising that Wisconsin, which of course is always in the mix, is a place that President Biden will visit more often than not. You know, Biden's not going to be visiting New York and California very often. He's going to be visiting Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, the usual places where just a few votes can tip the balance and shift a large number of electoral votes.
Now, if I'm running for office in one of these states, do I want these visits? I could look at, if I'm a Democrat, look at Biden's approval numbers. Yeah, they've been inching up some. He's still underwater. Former President Trump's approval numbers, often pretty low, not much better now that he's out of office. Do I want to keep them somewhat at arm's length?
Well, there are some difficult strategic choices for everyone involved. And a president can show up in a state without having many members of the congressional delegation in attendance. That's happened. But you know, on balance, at this stage, this far away from a presidential election, they're going to be very, very patient with the president. But you know, they realize too that the president's popularity is a big factor in their own chances for election or reelection. So if Biden can come in and do a good job and sway a few voters into thinking that the Republicans or the Democrats are the better choice, then that does even some of those Democrats who aren't too keen on Biden, it does them a favor. If Biden can bump up his numbers from the low 40s to the mid or high 40s, That could make a big difference 2 months from now.
I want to turn to the Senate a little bit now. What do we know about voters and their decision-making when it comes to, you know, do I like Ron Johnson or Mandela Barnes, our candidates here in Wisconsin, or do I want Democrats or Republicans to control the Senate? Are we thinking locally about these two particular candidates, or are we thinking nationally about, you know, who's in charge in Washington?
It's difficult to generalize. Voters vary widely in the factors that they take into account. Some are going to be partisan, and it doesn't matter who the candidates are or what the balance of power in Congress or in Washington happens to be. They're going to vote with party. And that's likely to be the case for the vast majority of voters. There will be some voters who will take into account, you know, very personalistic factors, like or dislike Ron Johnson, for example. The incumbent is usually more of a referendum on the incumbent than favoring the challenger. Their thoughts about the president, though, do make a difference. And even in Senate contests, attitudes about the incumbent president will influence their votes for in Senate races. Finally, there are a few voters who will be thinking about what the balance of power in Washington is likely to be after the election. Nearly everyone predicts that the House will become majority Republican. And so those middle of the road voters who might like to see the parties balanced and not have one party get too powerful, not have too big of a win, they could very easily vote for a Democrat in a House race and a Republican for the Senate race, or vice versa, depending upon how they see things working out. The idea there is that some voters actually like to see balanced parties in Washington without either of them becoming too powerful. Even though others would then say, well, that's just a recipe for gridlock. But that's the mix of attitudes that we actually see in the public right now. It's really quite a diverse public. There's no single kind of voter out there.
And Steve, something I wanted to ask you, we've got, you know, Wisconsin's very evenly divided when you have a statewide election. And, sure. You know, back in my political science classes days, I might think that would mean, okay, if we want to win an election, we've got to moderate and move toward the center, find ways to work together to represent the interests of people. Well, it seems like that's the opposite of what's happening. Why is that?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, and it has a lot to do with the fact that the Democrats are pretty much a liberal party and the Republicans pretty much a conservative party. There's far less of a mix of ideologies and policy perspectives in each party than there once was. If you want to make your way through a primary, get a nomination, and get to the general election ballot, you've got to appeal to your fellow partisans. And those fellow partisans now are more polarized than they used to be. So the Democrats are almost always going to nominate a liberal, and the Republicans always a conservative. And we get very few moderates elected. They don't make their way to the general election ballot in November. So it has to do with the kind of the sorting of people into sort of ideological camps that now are more closely tied to one party or the other. And that's been a long-term process over recent decades. It started way back in the 60s and 70s when the South, which had been one-party Democrat for more than a century, became increasingly Republican, making the Republican Party more conservative on balance. And a lot of Midwestern and Northeastern Republicans who were moderate to liberals, there was a time when Jacob Javits, a senator from New York, a Republican, was almost the most liberal member of Congress. Those moderate to liberal Republicans have disappeared. The same has happened on the Democratic side. Very few conservative Democrats remaining, although Southerners lost their seats or retired and were replaced by Republicans, leaving the Democrats to be more one-sidedly liberal. And that's been a long-term pattern. It's not going to be easy to come out of that. And it's hard to see exactly what political circumstances might break up that very monolistic nature of each party's electorate.
And we'll leave it there. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Rob.
That's Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the road to November and the big issues in the midterm elections. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, wild rice has a long history here in Wisconsin. The harvest season is coming up. Learn about the traditions and the ecology behind wild rice. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Hey, if you're doing any house cleaning over the next week, keep an eye out for little things that might be more valuable than you think. Like maybe there's a baseball card laying around that you could sell for over $12.5 million. As reported by NPR, a mint edition Mickey Mantle baseball card from 1952 sold at auction yesterday for $12.6 million. That sets the new record for the highest price ever paid for a piece of sports memorabilia. The previous record was a measly $9.3 million for a soccer jersey worn by the legendary Diego Maradona when he scored a controversial goal in the 1986 World Cup. This is a part of a trend we talked about early last year here on Central Time. During the pandemic, there was a boom in various kinds of sports collectibles. It's been driving prices up across the board. Makes me wish I'd hung on to my Kurt Bevacqua bubblegum blowing champion card from when I was a kid. That was during his brief stint, by the way, with the Milwaukee Brewers. It's probably worth something now, right? Probably not $12 million, though. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.